ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 12, entitled The Birth of Emperor Parikshit, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, verse number 33 on page 63. Tad abhipreta malakshya bratro chyuta choditaha dhanam prahinam ajahru udichang dishibhurishah tad abhipreta malakshya Prataro chuta choditaha dhanam prahinam ajahrur udicham dishibhurishah.
Tad abhipretam alaksham.
Tad abhipretam alaksha.
Bhrataro chyuta choditaha.
Bhrataro chyuta choditaha.
Dhanam prahinam ajahrur.
Dhanam prahinam ajahrur.
Udicham dishi bhurisha.
Udicham dishi bhurisha.
Tad abhipretam alaksha.
Tad abhipretam alaksha.
Bratarochit choditaha.
Bratarochuti choditaha.
Dhanam prahinam ajahur.
Dhanam prahinam ajahur.
Udicham dishi bhurisha.
Udicham dishi bhurisha.
Tadabhipretam alaksha.
Tadabhipretam alaksha.
Bhratro achyuta chodita.
Bhratro achyuta chodita.
Dhanam prahinam ajahur.
Dhanam prahitam ajahur.
Udichyan dishibhurisha.
Udichyan dishibhurisha.
Tat abhipretam alaksha.
Tat abhipretam alaksha.
Bhratro achyuta chodita.
Bhratro achyuta chodita.
Dhanam Prahinam ajarur.
Dhanam prahinam ajarur.
Udicham dishibhurishah.
Udicham dishibhurishah.
Tadabhipretam alaksha.
Tadabhipretam alaksha.
Bhratarochyuta chodita.
Bhratarochyuta choditaha.
Dhanam prahinam ajahrur.
Dhanam prahinam ajahrur.
Udicham dishibhurisha.
Udicham dishibhurisha.
Else? Someone else?
Tadabhipretam alaksha.
Tadabhipretam alaksha. Bhrataro chyuta choditaha. Dhanam prahinam ajahrur. Udicham dishibhurishah. Tat his abhipretam wishes of the mind. Alaksha observing. Bhrataraha his brothers, Achyuta, the infallible Lord Sri Krishna, Choditaha, being advised by, Dhanam, riches, Prahinam, to collect, Ajahru, brought about, Udicham, northern, Dishi, direction, Bhurishaha, sufficient. Translation. Understanding the hearty wishes of the king, his brothers, as advised by the infallible Lord Krishna, collected sufficient riches from the north left by King Maruta. Please repeat. Understanding the hearty wishes of the king, His brothers, as advised by the infallible Lord Krishna, collected sufficient riches from the north, left by King Maruta. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Maharaj Maruta, one of the great emperors of the world, he reigned over the world long before the reign of Maharaj Yudhishthira. He was the son of Maharaja Vikshit and was a great devotee of the sun god known as Yamaraj. His brother, Samvarta, was a rival priest of the great Brihaspati, the learned priest of the demigods. He conducted one sacrifice called Shankara Yajna, by which the Lord was so satisfied that he was pleased to hand over to him the charge of a mountain peak of gold. This peak of gold is somewhere in the Himalaya mountains, and modern adventurers may try to find it there. He was so powerful an emperor that at the day's end of sacrifice, the demigods from the other planets like Indra, Chandra, and Brihaspati used to visit his palace. And because he had the gold peak at his disposal, he had sufficient gold in his possession. The canopy of the sacrificial altar was completely made of gold. In his daily performances of the sacrificial ceremonies, some of the inhabitants of the Vayuloka, airy planets, were invited to expedite the cooking work of the ceremony. And the assembly of the demigods in the ceremony was led by Vishvadev. By his constant pious work, he was able to drive out all kinds of diseases from the jurisdiction of his kingdom. All the inhabitants of higher planets like Devaloka and Pitriloka were pleased with him for his great sacrificial ceremonies. Every day he used to give in charity to the learned brahmanas such things as beddings, seats, conveyances, and sufficient quantities of gold. Because of munificent charities and performances of innumerable sacrifices, the king of heaven, Indradeva, was fully satisfied with him and always wished for his welfare. Due to his pious activities, he remained a young man throughout his life and reigned over the world for 1,000 years, surrounded by his satisfied subjects, ministers, legitimate wife, sons, and brothers. Even Lord Sri Krishna praised his spirit and of pious activities. He handed over his only daughter to Maharshi Angira, and by his good blessings he was elevated to the kingdom. By his good blessings, that is Maharshi Angira, he was elevated to the kingdom of heaven. First of all, he wanted to offer the priesthood of his sacrifices to learned Brihaspati, but the demigod refused to accept the post because of the king's being a human being, a man of this earth. He was very sorry for this, but on the advice of Narada Muni, he appointed Samvarta to the post, and he was successful in his mission. Samvarta was his brother, I think, as we said before, the rival priest of the great Brihaspati. The success of a particular type of sacrifice completely depends on the priest in charge. In this age, all kinds of sacrifice are forbidden because there is no learned priest among the so-called brahmanas who go by the false notion of becoming sons of brahmanas without brahminical qualification. In this age of Kali, therefore, only one kind of sacrifice is recommended, Sankirtana Yajna, as inaugurated by Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sankirtana Yajna Ki Jai. Mountain of gold, a peak of gold in the Himalayas. Adventurers can go look for it there. It's one of those interesting statements. And is Srila Prabhupada giving us permission to go look for it? Or no? We're not adventurers, are we? But if we had it, we should use it for the service. We could try to use it for service. Otherwise, it might become a problem.
The entire Silicon Valley temple is made of gold.
Jai. If how will we find it? We don't. Maybe we should not. We should just give advice to those who find it, how they should use it, how they can use it. Actually, even without the gold, this Bill Gates has a big foundation. So we should find a way to get him to give some of that money to help spread the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita around the world and in the hotel rooms of the world. And there was a story, I don't know exactly how it went, but there was one Swami, who somehow had some nervous, affliction where his hands would go behind his back or something, and I don't know the exact story, but the story was someone was bragging that his guru was so great that if you put so much money in front of him, his hands would go back and he wouldn't touch it, you know. And Srila Prabhupada said, "Oh, they should let me take. I'll take it like this." But he would use it. Prabhupada would use it, not for any material, mundane purpose, for sense gratification. There's already so many people misusing the wealth of this world, and therefore the people are suffering. But if you use it properly, apply it properly in sacrifice, then the entire universe, all the demigods, and Krishna will be pleased and bestow all blessings to make a very nice situation. Just like this king, Maharaj Maruta, he was able to rid his kingdom of disease by performance of sacrifice. The modern medical science, they may cure some disease in one way or another, but they can't cure all disease. And they don't know this method of sacrifice. They consider it, you know, like some backward thing, that why do you believe in a superstition that you have to placate some higher beings? And so science is not in and of itself bad. The concept of using one's senses for material, or rather for empirical research, and for increasing the stock of knowledge by keeping track of what happens, and if you use it in different ways, experiments in different ways. Of course, it's bad to experiment on poor animals, laboratory animals, and some of the other unethical things that scientists do in their methods. But in and of itself, the method of scientific inquiry and explanation of things is not bad. But the tendency is that they want to say this is the only way to achieve knowledge, or this, and then to ridicule other superior methods, and empirical research, experimentation, explanation, and peer-reviewed publication stuff is very limited in what it can tell you about the world. I mean, it can't tell you anything about what's beautiful or what isn't beautiful. It can't tell you anything about. Maybe you could say you could ask people what their opinion is of what's beautiful, and you can do survey research like that. But you can't say, you don't have a theory of aesthetics based on empirical research, nor do you have a theory of ethics based on empirical research. They can't tell you what is just, what is good, what is right, and what is wrong. In fact, there's a fact-value dichotomy. Values aren't supposed to be intrude on the world of science in a way. And they can't tell you anything about the spiritual world or spiritual nature. So the most important things that people need in their lives can't be explained. But practical problems may be solved through technology and so forth. Better living through chemistry or whatever. I remember these slogans I used to see on TV for these companies that were actually participating in nuclear weapons and, all other kinds of horrible things. And then they would have these nice advertisements. Like, you still see them, the oil companies, making the world a better place. British Petroleum, Meanwhile, there's this big spill in the Gulf of Mexico that's killing all the fish and everything. But the sacrifice is the sure way. We can hear from superior authorities who actually know about right and wrong and beauty and ugliness and spirit and matter and Supreme Spirit and our relationship to Him. They know how to cure all miseries. We were talking about that earlier. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is singing how Lord Chaitanya is telling the people, "I brought the medicine." Enechi oshoti maya nashi barulagi. I can cure the disease from which you're suffering. You might cure some heart disease or some kidney disease or something, or make some temporary cure, because eventually something is going to kill you. Right? Even though they've made so many advances, they still, human life is about 100 years. They haven't been able to make the people living to 150, 200 years. And some of their methods are very, like these Ugra Karma Kali Yuga methods. When I was in college, they were always talking about how we can make the mechanical hips now, we can make the mechanics. So soon we'll make mechanical hearts and eventually mechanical brains, and we'll just replace people with all mechanical parts. But the real disease we're suffering from, we, the living entity, the real, we're not these bodies, we're spirit soul, and our nature, our proper engagement is to serve Krishna. And the real disease we're suffering from is we've forgotten that service. We came into this world of birth and death promising, oh Lord, certainly I shall serve you, but we've forgotten that promise and we've remained in great ignorance. And if we found a mountain of gold, God knows what we would do with it, but probably something not very good. When it should be used, like this king Maharaj Maruta, great king of the past, was able to use it so very nicely in performance of sacrifice. But nowadays we don't have the right priests to perform the sacrifice. He had asked Brihaspati to be the priest. I don't know where this story is. This from the Mahabharata, or I don't know where this story. Srila Prabhupada is telling this story. I don't know. I don't know where it's which literature it's recorded in. But this king asked Brihaspati to become the priest, and Brihaspati refused because he said, "You're on earth, on man. I'm the priest in the heavenly kingdom." So the king was very disappointed. But Narada Muni said, "You should take your brother and make him the priest," and the brother successfully performed the sacrifice. It's science. It's if you perform the sacrifice successfully, you get the result. And if you don't perform the sacrifice successfully, you don't get the result. It's very practical. But we don't see the success of these Vedic sacrifices of this type anymore. Because they don't have the priests who actually know how to properly perform the sacrifice. Nor do they have the mountain of gold to provide all the things with which to satisfy all the demigods and brahmanas, and everyone has to be properly remunerated in the sacrifice, and everyone has to be given their portion. But we have to do sacrifice. Evang pravartatang chakrang. Yeah. So one who lives without sacrifice lives in vain. It's a cycle. Devan devayatayena, devan bhavayatayena, te devan bhavayanti vaha, bhavayanti parasparam. And yagya shishtashinak santo muchyante sarva kilvishai. Punjate te twagam papam, ye pachantyatma karanat. All these are from the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Anad bhavanti bhutani parjanyat na sambhavo, yagyat bhavati parjanyo, yagya karma samud bhavaha, karma brahmod bhavavidhi, brahmaksharam anud bhavam, tasmat sarvagatang brahma, nityang yagya pratishtita. So he's recommending yagya, that the transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice which are prescribed in the Vedas and which are born of work. In order to do a sacrifice, you have to work. You have to have, you have to gather the ingredients and set up the arena correctly, the place to do the sacrifice. So much work is required for pleasing the higher authorities, the superior. The demigods, being satisfied by the sacrifice, they bestow all the necessities on man. There's a interdependence. What do you call it when you have, one hand washes the other? There's a symbiotic relationship. The demigods, actually they depend on the being properly respected by human beings and being properly offered sacrifice. Of course, if we sacrifice, if we please Krishna through our sacrifice, the demigods are automatically satisfied, even more satisfied than if we approach them independently and worship them separately. This king, it said, he was a great devotee of Yamaraj, who was the son of the god of the sun. Hare Krishna. But all of these demigods, like Yamaraj, is there in the sixth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam explaining to the Yamadutas that those who are servants of Vishnu, they're the most... Yamaraj is explaining, I'm also a devotee of Vishnu. I have to please Vishnu. And any devotees of Vishnu are... Don't... tells the Yamadutas, don't bother them. Don't molest them. So the sacrifice for this age is the Sankirtan Yajna. And we're doing the monthly Sankirtan festival. So we're engaged in the performance of sacrifice, the proper performance of sacrifice, and the proper method prescribed in this age. And people should be encouraged to be chanting holy names of God, worshipping His archa form, vigraha in the temple. And our acharyas have determined, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, after years of chanting 300,000 names a day, he came out and started this great movement for the benefit of society, this Hare Krishna movement, organized, institutional, organized preaching. And he always was racking his brain to determine how will the people in the world be able to become devotees of Krishna? How will they be able to be saved and take up this process of Harinam Sankirtan and stop quarreling about different pointless things and take up the real necessity of the soul, which is to properly praise Krishna. And then he determined that it should be through book distribution. That you can go out and chant, and we must go out and chant, but he said a mridanga can only be heard for a few blocks, but the printing press is like the giant mridanga that can be heard throughout the world. And when we print books about Krishna, and authorized books written by realized pure devotees, and we distribute those books about Krishna and discuss them amongst ourselves and encourage people to study them and discuss them, it's something very tangible. It's authorized. People can see it in a form. It's considered like standard knowledge. It's, if you talk and you can rent a lecture hall and you can give a speech about Krishna, and people may think it's very nice and clap and applaud, but they go away back to their ordinary life again, and it doesn't create any really substantial mission within the world. So even before Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, Lord Chaitanya established this mission on the earth. He deputed his disciples, Rupa Goswami and Sanatan Goswami, and he ordered them to write books. And they wrote books. They wrote these amazing books, very high-level theological explanation of what is really God, and his, and what is really devotion, what is really religion, what is really devotion to God, in great detail. And then their nephew, Jiva Goswami, wrote a gigantic treatise called the Sandarbha, Sat Sandarbha, and explain and analyzed it from all, just like Srimad Bhagavatam explains that the absolute, the divinity can be realized in three features. It's non-dual substance. It's substance, it's reality, and it's non-dual. It's not like material things. We have one object here and one object there, and there are two different objects. But everything spiritual is non-different from everything else spiritual. And this non-dual substance can be realized in three phases as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. And although they can be distinguished, these different features can be distinguished from one another, yet they all exist in this realm where the subject, the knower and the known are both the same, not, at least in quality. they're of the same quality, and there's no distinction there. And yet there is another kind of distinction that's important. So all this is, it sounds complicated, but it can be realized by pure devotees, and it's explained in complete, glorious detail in this literature by the acharyas, the Vaishnava acharyas, after Lord Chaitanya. And Srila Prabhupada has taken all those conclusions and presented them in simple language for modern people in his books like Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Nectar of Instruction, Nectar of Devotion, Srimad Bhagavatam. And then he's ordered his disciples that you print, you translate these books into all languages of the world, you print them profusely, and you distribute them profusely to all the people. And of course, not only we distribute them, but we also read them and discuss them and take benefit from them and encourage other people to read them. And just that they noticed, just like in the 20th century in Bengal, the Communist Party had books by Marx and Lenin and Engels and Bakunin and so forth. And they had study groups, and people would be told, you know, hey, you have nothing to lose but your chains. Get up and, you know, unite, whatever. They were told this philosophy of Marxism, Leninism. This is a way to organize a movement, both literature. You have to have some literature, and you take the literature around, and you tell people, study this. We have a doctrine. Of course, doctrine isn't what we're not just interested in indoctrinating everybody into some words, some theories, some formulas, some logical, you know, categories. You have to actually chant and change your heart. Become a real disciple, surrender to a spiritual master, become a real lover of Krishna, become really detached from material sense pleasure, control the senses, use them in service and sacrifice. All these things, you have to really transform your personality, your being, to become a liberated person. But nevertheless, we do have some doctrine. We can explain it. It's reasonable. It's not dogmatic. We're not simply saying, you know, God says this, and I'm the representative of God, and I'm going to make you frightened. If you don't do what we say, you'll be punished in hell, and you'll burn, and anybody who doesn't agree with our group is an infidel, and we'll fight them. And you know, that kind of religion is causing people to disrespect religion in the world. In Europe, in the 16th century, there was this reformation within the Catholic Church, or revolt from the Catholic Church, according to which side you're on, and it caused a lot of wars. And there were wars before that. There were wars between the Muslims and the Christian version of, the Abrahamic tradition, Jewish tradition, whatever. And they're saying, you know, the other people. I mean, someone told me, I was reading a book. It says in the Quran, their holy book, you know, if you meet a Jew, you should kill him, or something like that. You know, actually says that in their holy book. So, according to this girl, a Muslim author, member of Parliament of Holland that I was reading, she says people don't, you know, they should know what the Quran actually says and not be, you know, just put off this thing. But Krishna consciousness is not like that. It's reasonable and it's universal. There's one kind of soul, every living being. Krishna says knowledge in the mode of goodness means understanding. There's one kind of life force that is in all living, in all beings. And it's not a matter of, just forming into a group, one group against another group, and frightening people through, you know, authoritarian, you know, these are the rules and you have to follow them. Don't ask questions. We want questions. No, we say don't ask irrelevant questions, but get an understanding. It's the duty of a disciple to get a complete understanding of the science of God from the realized spiritual master who can explain everything reasonably with all, you know, respect to logic and philosophy, so that you can understand it. But it's not simply some kind of academic process. It's a matter of actually changing the heart, changing the way, changing your, getting a higher kind of consciousness, Krishna consciousness. And when you get that Krishna consciousness, it makes you peaceful, and it naturally makes you, when you experience a higher taste, parang drishva nivartate, then you can easily give up a lower taste. So when you experience a higher kind of happiness, a happiness that doesn't come from exploiting matter, but it comes from dedicating everything to serving Krishna in sacrifice, then you find it, as you become purified, as your heart becomes purified, then automatically you give up that exploitative, that attempt, that feeling that I'll only be happy if I can exploit and dominate others. And Srila Prabhupada would always say, he would always be confronted, well, why this religion? Why are you coming here and teaching some foreign religion in our country? We already have a religion, Christianity. Sometimes Prabhupada would say, yes, but your young people aren't following that religion anymore for some reason. I'm not saying your religion is wrong, but they don't seem attracted to it, but they're being attracted to me, what I'm saying. So why not, what's wrong with that? They're actually becoming lovers of God. If whatever your religious system teaches is causing people to become lovers of God, then we respect that. And we're not trying to change people from their religion. We're hoping that, as we're distributing these Bhagavad Gitas into motel rooms, but we don't want anyone to feel that it's a threat. We met one motelier from Bradenton, Florida yesterday, and 2 years ago he took the books into his rooms, and he said he's had a lot of comments of people that come out and say, thank you, you know, we like it. He's actually involved. He's not just some investor that has a motel somewhere else, but he's actually involved. He said he has one employee, an American guy, who's a night auditor. He has to stay up all night at the front desk, and he does the books, but then he's there, you know, in case anyone comes in the door, something happens at 3 a.m. So he has to stay up there. So the night auditor, he picked up the book and he read the whole Bhagavad Gita, and he loved it. And then there was some Christian convention that came through, and so the whole convention was staying in the motel. And the pastor came to I want to see the manager, and he showed him the book. He said, what is this? And Mr. Patel said, sir, this is, you know, the Bhagavad Gita is a very sacred, holy book of Hindus, and it explains, you know, about God. And the pastor said, I don't like this, you know. He said, but we also have Bible, Gideon's Bible in the rooms, but we also have our holy book, and it's a very nice book, you know. The pastor was saying, this is, you know, you shouldn't have these books. Jesus is the only way. And then the night auditor popped up, the American guy, and he said, no, have you read the book? Then you can't criticize it until you read it. What do you don't know what you're talking about? I read this whole book, and it's a very good book. You should read it. It will teach you things about you. You're a pastor. You should know about God. You should read this book, you know. And Vaishasika was saying, if you get one copy of the, if you hand me a Bhagavad Gita, he was saying, someone was saying that they're distributing books, and someone might say, well, I'm a Catholic, you know. I don't want this book, I'm a Catholic. So Vaishasika said, look here, in the very beginning here, we have all these different professors from different colleges. Here's one, Thomas Merton, Catholic theologian, monk, and author. He's actually a very famous Trappist monk, and in the 1960s, he was one of the most famous Catholic writers. And he actually wrote the introduction, or the foreword, one of the forewords in the 1968 edition of Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. And this is an excerpt from that. The Gita can be seen as the main literary support for the great religious civilization of India, the oldest surviving culture in the world. This present translation and commentary is another manifestation of the permanent and living importance of the Gita. Swami Bhaktivedanta brings to the West a salutary reminder. Salutary means healthy, health-producing reminder that our highly activistic and one-sided culture is faced with a crisis that may end in self-destruction because it lacks the inner depth of an authentic metaphysical consciousness. Without such depth, our moral and political protestations are just so much verbiage. So here you have one saintly person from the Catholic tradition appreciating another saintly person from the Hindu Vedic tradition, recognizing that this is the real solution to the problems in the world, and not this, you know, not this fighting and political activism, but inner depth of an authentic metaphysical consciousness. So, you know, why should they feel that, oh, this is foreign? It's not foreign. This is the actual universal religion of the soul, Jiva Dharma. There's one book by Bhaktivinoda Thakur called Jiva Dharma. Krishna consciousness is the eternal, you know, natural quality, natural virtue in the old sense of the word virtue, is, you know, means that a thing is known by its particular power. A certain drug will have a certain virtue that makes it act in a certain way or something like that. So in Aristotelian ethics, each person has his own nature and he's supposed to actually achieve the perfection of that particular nature. I don't even remember the Greek word eudaimonia or I forget. Eudaimonia, I can't even remember my old philosophy class. But dharma means that, like, the dharma of sugar is to be sweet, the dharma of water is to be red. Everything has its own nature. Everyone according to they have, and therefore they have some role to play in the world. According to the natural universal order of things, they have some proper role to play, and their perfection is to play their role properly. You know, if we sing in a choir, we all have to sing our part, and we have to sing it at the right time and the right key and everything. And the role to play for the living entity is the real eternal role, that which doesn't change. I may, in this life, I may have one, you know, I may be one kind of person, maybe a man, a woman, I may be an American, an Indian, or African, or whatever. But the one thing that's eternal, that doesn't change about any living entity, all living entities, I may even be an animal or a plant in some other life, but the one thing that's eternal is every soul is a servant of Krishna. And that that duty to serve Krishna, that doesn't change in anyone. That's the constant. So Lord Chaitanya said, Jivera Swarupai Krishnera Nitya Das. That's the, if you want to know what is the actual nature, the actual eternal nature of all living beings, their swarup, their actual identity. Right? We have to know our real identity. That identity is to be an eternal servant of Krishna. And by chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, that is the proper method of sacrifice in this age, and it automatically cleans our heart and makes us realize what our real identity is. Otherwise, we're under the misconception of false ego, we engage in activities which degrade us and cause our misfortune. So this is the key, this is the disease, the cure to the disease, the ashodhi that destroys Maya, and will stop all disease. And it's the proper method of sacrifice. Is how we should actually use the wealth. Whatever wealth comes to us should be used properly in sacrifice. If we can find a mountain peak of gold, we use it for sankirtan. We could buy a nice temple here for Sri Sri Radha Madana Mohan in Silicon Valley, but also, and we have to maintain the temple, not just to buy a big building and then not have anything to do with it. But more than that, rather than a monument, a building or a monument of that kind, more important is to distribute the books and get people to understand. There's a play called Inherit the Wind. It was a play about the trial of some fundamentalists had passed a law in Tennessee in the 1920s that you couldn't teach the theory of evolution in school or it would be a crime. And one man named Scopes, named in the play, they renamed him Cates, but it was the Scopes monkey trial. Anyway, I was just remembering, they had one kind of wisecracking journalist who was in the play who was kind of based on, loosely based on the character of H.L. Mencken, an American journalist and author, kind of a muckraking journalist, and He wrote for American Mercury. And but the character that was kind of like him, it was named, I think it was Brady. Anyway, he said, an idea is a greater monument than a cathedral. In a child's power to master the multiplication table, there's more power than in all your amens and holy holies and stuff. So he was a cynic, Mencken. And this, I forget even who wrote this play, Inherit the Wind. It was really about, or so the literary professors were telling us, although it was talking about the evolution, the controversy of public school education and stuff, it was really about what was going on in the 50s was the witch hunts against communists and stuff, and they were talking, but there was the same, this kind of fundamentalist mentality of persecuting the other and, you know, so forth. But I just remember that phrase that the journalist said, an idea is a greater monument than a cathedral. So even though he had some atheistic and anti-religious motivation in there, because, and the religion wasn't all that, the old-time religion, they were kind of making fun of it, that it was this, you know, give me that old-time religion, it was kind of a fundamentalist. There was actually an American politician named William Jennings Bryan, who had been, the Democratic candidate for president a couple elections in a row, and he was in favor of bimetallism, you know, increasing the money supply and helping the poor farmers. So he was a populist politician, and then he didn't get elected, but he ended his career sort of pushing fundamentalist Christianity in the United States. It's kind of, we see still, now it's the Republican Party mainly that has this evangelical Christian wing of it. But I like the idea is a greater monument than a cathedral. And it shows a fundamental idealism that, you know, there's something more important inside us than what is outside us. Of course, you know, the play Inherit the Wind is down on religion and stuff, but the idea that is there is that if you can get someone to actually be Krishna conscious, that is greater success than to, you know, build some monument to Krishna consciousness that people can all come and say, oh yes, this is, you know, the world may be full of big temples and structures, and they're important. They help remind people of Krishna, but that's what they're there for, to remind people of Krishna. The essence is the internal Krishna consciousness. And so to keep that up, we have to keep the book distribution, the Sankirtan up. It's the, like we say, eat to live, not live to eat, but then live to what? To glorify Krishna. And like some people have a religious system, it's kind of the opposite idea, you know. Worship in order to eat, right? You perform some religious activity, and then you get some economic development from it. And this is, you know, how people are encouraged to do religious activity. If you don't do it, something bad will happen. If you do it, something good will happen. And then Narada Muni, in the second chapter of the fifth chapter of the Srimad, first canto, he was telling Vyasadeva, you have to compose the Srimad Bhagavatam. And he says, actually, you've done it. You've misled everyone by encouraging them to perform, to act religiously in order to, have some material success. They won't be willing to give up their material attachment. You know, yeah, they can act religiously, but they're doing it for the wrong reason, and then they won't be able to become detached and become perfect. So you should describe the pastimes of Krishna. You should go into trance, like we read about how he was in his ashram and he saw the personality of Godhead and his material energy under full control. So the idea is a greater monument than cathedral means, yeah, we should have a cathedral, we should have a big temple for Krishna, but also what do we have it for is to actually instill Krishna consciousness in the hearts of the people of the Bay Area. And all the people of the Bay Area. That's what I was telling the motel owners. You know, you're here and you're thinking, this is my culture, I'm going to preserve my culture. But you're not going to preserve your culture unless you make the Americans accept your culture because you're living here and your kids are going to go to the schools here and they're going to marry Americans and they're just going to accept their culture is going to be whatever's on MTV or whatever's in the public consciousness culture. So you can't just try to protect your own social group, you know, immigrant group or enclave or something like that. It's not going to work like that. What you have to do is actually promote real Krishna consciousness everywhere throughout the world and make the whole world truly dedicated to performing sacrifice. The sacrifice for this age is the Sankirtan Jagya, Nama Sankirtan. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Hare Krishna. I have one question. Is like you mentioned that like on the hotel occasion, so like when we go to the book distribution or sometimes, so we distribute the Bhagavad Gita's as it is, and some Christian people is there on the road, right? And we give them Bhagavad Gita. So if they ask like, have you read the Bible or Quran? So what like our reaction is supposed to be time that?
And just honestly, if you've read it, you can tell them you read it. If you haven't read it, you can tell them you haven't read it. Their motivation, their kind of idea is that the only kind of religious success is to specifically accept their own very narrow way. And you have to realize that you're dealing with someone with that mentality. And so you're probably wasting your time talking to them. That's why they're very imperialistic, and they're sending the missionaries to go, and they have money, and so they go and make converts in India. You know, shouldn't be a Hindu. Hindus worship many gods, and there's only one real God, and it's not your God, it's my God, and stuff like that. They have this idea, how can there be more than one God, you know? But that's their idea. You know, we have God. He's in our group. He only came one time, and the only manifestation was Jesus. You know, I always try to tell them a reasonable thing. God is so great, he's unlimited. Why would he only have one son? I say, what it says in the Bible, he gave his only begotten son, and whoever so believes in him, and he's the only way, the truth, and the life. So they're always saying, no, he's the only begotten son. You can't say that Prabhupada is also his son. You can't say that Bhaktisiddhanta is also his son, or Narada Muni is also his son. Only Jesus. You know, that's their mentality. You could say if a man has only one son, he's not very opulent, you know. And another man may have 10 great sons, you know. Rishabhadev Maharaj had 100 great sons, and they were all wonderful sons. So why should God be less than that? But when it says that he loved the world so much that he gave his only begotten son, the mood is that if a man has only one son, he loves that son so much. And then even if he's willing to, for the benefit of spreading pure religious knowledge, he's willing to even allow his son to be sacrificed by the unbelieving mob who crucifies him or something. That shows how important it is to preach. It shows how important it is that God loves the world, and his message is to save everyone in the world. But they don't understand it in that way. They understand it. You know, we've got the exclusive group. If you don't accept our, you know, tribal totem, you know, we're the clan of the bear, and if you don't accept the bear, you know, we're against the wolf people, you know, or something like that. It's a primitive kind of religion.
So, bro, like,
but don't talk to them too much, I think.
Okay, but honestly, like, you know, like, if we say someone, you should try to read this Bhagavad Gita book, so should we honestly read some other books or not? Because we already accept, like, so...
Yeah, we don't have to be exclusive. We should read Prabhupada's books and spend our time really understanding Prabhupada's books. But then for the purpose of preaching, we should not be there's obscurantism. That we should say, I don't know anything but my own little book. Prabhupada said you should know a little of everything and everything of something. You know? You could be a jack of all trades, but you also have to be a master of something. We should be a master of Prabhupada's book, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita. And then we can explain to them, you know, yes.
Just to add to your point, also it depends on what our level of faith is. For example, if our faith is not strong, and initially if we read too many books and too many philosophies, there is every chance that we might also get influenced and our faith in Krishna may not be really strong.
Yes. So over-collecting is a problem. The Atyahara Prayashascha Prajalpo Niyamagraha, there are six things that are destroy devotional service. They're bad for devotional service. And one of them is overeating. But overeating also means accumulating too many things. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur has warned us that just reading a whole lot of books to become, you know, this, you know, sort of someone who knows everything and who's, and you know, who can always, you know, quote, you know, oh, Chateaubriand said this, and you know, Thomas Jefferson said that, and you know, that can be just another kind of overeating, over acquiring, over accumulating things. But we're not afraid, you know, the soul can't be cut by weapons or burned by fire, and Krishna consciousness is dominant. It's powerful. It's a powerful culture. So we, you know, we go to Christians and we say, we have this Bhagavad Gita, and their response is really, they're really afraid of it a little bit, because they know, they actually have faith in, it's good. We don't want to disturb their faith. They have some faith in God, and it brings them some sense of spiritual, contact, that they have some experience of some spiritual love, and they feel some relief from materialism and things like that. But it's frightening to them that somebody else has another book that's giving the same thing. They can see it in our eyes that we also have faith and we also have spiritual contact. We also have relief, and it challenges their ideology that they're the only way, and so it disturbs them. And it's often better. What I do is I have these little pamphlets produced by Christians about vegetarianism. I noticed that when Srila Prabhupada met Christian, you know, dignitaries, priests and you know, ministers and cardinals and things, one of the things he always hit on was, you know, that Jesus says you should not kill. The Bible says you should not kill. And people should be vegetarians. It's violent to kill the animals. You know, they also are living beings. And, you know, sometimes the priest would say, but the animals don't really have souls. They're put here for us to enjoy. And Srila Prabhupada would say, is that reasonable? You know, if you pinch a man, he screams. If you pinch a dog, he screams. You know, if you cut him, he bleeds. If you cut him, he bleeds. There's Merchant of Venice, a play by Shakespeare. There's a Jewish banker, and it's actually kind of an anti-Semitic play. Shylock, yeah. But he makes this argument that even though I'm Jewish, am I not a man? If you pinch me, I'm sore. If you cut me, I bleed. And Prabhupada used the same argument. What about the dog? What about the cow? You know, it's how can you say it has no soul? What's the difference? Yes, it doesn't do philosophy. It doesn't write books, but it still feels pain, and that's the real point. The point of not doing violence is you shouldn't want to cause pain to other people. Isn't the golden rule that you should do to others what you want others to do to you? You shouldn't unnecessarily cause anyone to have pain if you're acting justly, properly. Anyway, so there's these pamphlets that are published by some Christians that say that a real Christian should be a vegetarian. So when I meet these Christians on Book Distribution, and some, you know, I meet some Christians who are actually engaged, they want to examine religion reasonably and discuss it, and they're willing to talk to people of other religions. I mean, I just read an article by Bishop Desmond Tutu, a fabulous article where he's saying all the same things that I'm saying, that, you know, if your religious system brings you love of God, brings you spiritual fruits, then it's successful. And he says, of course, you know, I'm from a tradition where we say that, you know, God came to earth one time as a human being, as Jesus, and I'd like people to accept that. But I can appreciate other traditions that say something different, but they have the same spirit. So you'll meet those kind of Christians, and it's nice to meet them and give them books, and you can respect them, and you don't have to be afraid to read their books if your faith is a little steady. It won't, you know, it won't. But you're not going to become a Christian, I'm not worried about that. You know, if you chant Hare Krishna You're not going to turn your back on the Vedic culture. But it's not, we don't spend our time studying other books and just doing interfaith dialogue. You know, there's a certain devotees that there's a value for, one kind of preaching we do, we try to talk people into becoming, worship Krishna, surrender to Krishna, join our temple and everything. Another kind of preaching we do is that there, we meet established people throughout the world who are not, you know, who already have some established position somewhere else, and they're not going to actually chant Hare Krishna and join our temple. But if they can respect Krishna consciousness and we can have good relations with them and mutual respect, real respect on a platform of real knowledge, that's a good kind of, that's important kind of thing to. But when you meet the, and you'll know, you'll be able to know who they are, when you meet the evangelical closed-minded Christians who have absolutely no interest in reading Bhagavad Gita because their mood is militant and their idea is that we're going to conquer the world for our religion. And everyone has to join us and bow down to our religion, our church, or our version of it. You know, this is the only way. You're wasting your time to talk to them. And but, you know, I grew up in this country, so if they say, do you know, I say, yeah, I do know something of the Bible. And I know the verses that you're quoting to me, and I know what you're going to say next, and I can tell you. But do you know Bhagavad Gita? And why not? It's not a competition. Like, when the one thing I didn't like, we were playing at the motel convention, we were playing the CBS News story where they interviewed Vaishasika and they interviewed Dilip Bhai and so forth, and talking about, you know, soon coming to a hotel nightstand near you, Bhagavad Gita. But in the beginning of the show, they were saying, competition for Gideons. You know, and because that's the way... the people perceive religion a lot, that, you know, like when my wife was raised Catholic, and in her youth at least, the mood was, they were told actually, but the priests would say, if you go, you know, your friend is a Lutheran, she's also a Christian, almost the same kind of, you know, little differences in doctrine, what do they believe about what happens to the bread during the Mass, whether it actually becomes the body of Jesus or it only symbolically represents the body of Jesus. But if you go to their temple or they go to their church, you've committed a sin and you have to atone for it. You know. Whereas, like Dilip Bhai was telling me, you know, his father is a Vaishnava, so he was growing up in England. There was no Hindu temple in his village. So his father sent him to the Methodist church. He said, well, you know, God is there. Why not? You could go you learn something about God. I want you to learn something about God anyway, and sent him to that church. But he didn't. But he didn't lose his. He's a Vaishnava through and through. So he didn't lose his faith in Krishna. But sometimes, if they find out that you have faith in Krishna or whatever, they're going to say, oh, you know. Why do they say? Why do they not? Why are they threatened by Krishna? It's just that they have a poor fund of knowledge. They haven't experienced how nice Krishna is yet. They haven't experienced how really, like they said this phrase, what would Jesus do? You know? And people can have different answers, but I say, Jesus would be introducing Bhagavad Gita, preaching Bhagavad Gita today, you know, and putting them in motel rooms. But they don't understand that. They can't perceive that. So when you meet them on book distribution, it's important to recognize who's just, you know, their mind is just going to be like, you know, how can I assert that I'm better than you and that your system is wrong and that you're a, you know, benighted savage and we're civilized Christians or something like that. You know, when you meet those kind of imperialistic, militant, evangelical Christians, you're wasting your time talking to them. You should just say, it's so nice to meet someone who has such strong faith. You know, have a nice day and go on to the next person who might take a book. Because these people are, what they're telling you is it's part of their understanding of how to please God that they shouldn't read this book. So don't waste your time trying to make them read the book. And even, you know, but one time, I'm taking too long, but one time I was in the, I was fried by meeting so many of those people. And I was in the airport in Los Angeles Airport, And I started talking to this man, and he seemed very nice, and he listened to me talk and make a nice presentation and everything. And then he said, you know, I believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. And I just stopped talking to him, turned around, walked away, and went to approach somebody else. And then later, a senior book distributor, Pragosh Das, was there. And he came to me and he said, you know, that man just came up to me and he said that, you know, he gave me $10 and took the Bhagavad Gita. But he said that you just turned around and walked away from him. Why did you do that? And I said, because he said, I believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. I thought he was another one of those, you know, Christians just coming to bust my chops and try to tell me that, you know, if I didn't get saved in a very particular way, in a very specific thing, that I was worthless, you know. And so you have to discriminate, you know, you have to be sensitive enough to know where they're coming from, listen to them enough to know where they're coming from. But if you can perceive that you're absolutely wasting your time, don't sit and try to, don't spend an hour, you know, trying to convince them that, well, we think this way, and it's going to, you're going to miss somebody who's supposed to be getting the Bhagavad Gita. And by doing that, when you're out there, you know, you should use your time wisely. Yes, Raksha Prabhu.
When you hear about Christians taking this attitude, it comes across as very divisive. That is, it's just leading to division. They say ours is better than yours. Mm-hmm. And somehow it seems that these religions are unable to cross this common bridge, that the goal, our goal and their goal is the same, and that is to realize God. And you pointed out they are in the mode of ignorance or so. So there is room then for them to become a little bit enlightened. I mean, what are they preaching if they think that this is only it and yours is all trash? Then how good is their preaching too? And it would seem that this would open up some type of a room for a dialogue where they would be told, if there is such a forum, that we are not in competition. That mm-hmm. what we are preaching and what you are preaching are on parallel lines. And even with Jesus Christ, there is no problem. He did have a message. Even Srila Prabhupada in his book acknowledges he was mm-hmm. a man of God. So he was on the right path. We are on that path. So that common understanding somehow has to emerge in some type of a dialogue for these parties to come together. Otherwise, it would be divisive. They will just fight each other till death. There won't be any progress.
And there are such dialogues. There are enlightened leaders, intelligent leaders in all world religions. Bhakti Swarup Damodar Goswami was one of the founding members of an organization called the United Religions Initiative. I think he's Presbyterian, or there was a bishop. No, he would be Episcopalian probably. So a bishop swig or something in San Francisco. He said, well, we have a United Nations where different countries can have, you know, diplomatic solutions to their grievances and problems. They can meet together and, you know. He said, we don't have anything for religions like that. So he founded this United Religions Initiative, and he wanted to bring people in from different religious backgrounds so that they could form personal friendships with each other and have dialogue, know what's of concern to their community. You know, we could tell them, you know, we're concerned about the evangelical proselytizing in India, where they're trying to make converts and stuff, and they can be sensitive to that. And, you know, those kind of dialogues. So Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj also participated in that particular organization. And there are many such organizations, but he participated in helping draft the charter and helping. They organized themselves in different little community groups. And they took delegates, you know, 350 or 400 delegates from all different religions, you know, even African animist groups, and, you know, but certainly a lot of Muslims, Jewish, Christian people, Buddhist people, and Native American religion and things like that. And they went to Mayapur for one of their annual conventions, and they took prasadam, And I think they allowed them that those who needed it could drink coffee, or and they, maybe they had a place where they could smoke cigarettes somewhere if they really needed to, or something like that. And there were videos of the meetings on they were posted in some articles on Dandavats and stuff. And I was out distributing books in San Francisco one day, and I met someone who was one of the delegates who had gone there to Mayapur for that, and said what a wonderful time it was and what a spiritual atmosphere. And there are people of goodwill in all religions, and there are also probably, you know, Hare Krishna devotees who may act like fundamentalists sometimes with other people, you know. So we should understand that Krishna consciousness is not a matter of, you know, we shouldn't try to use Krishna consciousness to dominate others, but actually that we're giving out something very sweet, very nice, as a benefit to others. On the order of Lord Chaitanya, who's the father of all living beings, he wants them all to be happy in chanting Krishna's name. And you're right, like Prabhupada said, suppose you don't want to chant Hare Krishna, you say, I'm a Christian, so then you can chant Christ. You can chant Lord Jesus Christ, or you can make your prayers different Christian prayers that they already have. Lord Chaitanya wanted to increase the sankirtan, and he was non-sectarian. That is, you know, that the Muslims are chanting Allah, Allah, you know, Allahu Akbar, whatever. So we appreciate they're taking a holy name of God. There are different kinds of names of God. You know, some of them are they're describing qualities of, you know, functional things, the creator or something, and then there are other names that are more intimate names, like the son of Mother Yashoda or something. But we encourage everyone to chant the holy names of God in whatever tradition you are and realize God. But don't make it into this political, you know, in the Kali Yuga atmosphere, everybody's more concerned with, you know, who will have power, who will have wealth, you know, who will be the authority, and, you know, and that's a universal problem. So when we're out distributing books, we sometimes meet people who have that kind of, you know, bee in their bonnet, that they're not really interested in reading Bhagavad Gita. They really want to tell you that unless you only read the Bible and nothing else, you know, you're fallen. But they don't only read, you know, I guarantee you those same people, you know, go back and watch Hollywood movies and you know, have other entertainments and, you know, even, you know, sinful entertainments often. But they like to, you know, sort of wrap themselves up in their sense of self-righteousness when they see, oh, there's somebody worshiping God in another way that I don't understand. And it's better not to fight with them or waste your time arguing against them. You can't really do them much good. So what I do is I give them a little pamphlet that says, oh, you're not interested in this because you're a Christian and you think this is not for you. Well, we have something produced by Christians, and it talks about vegetarianism in the Bible and why, you know, the mood of real Christians should be one of brotherly love, even to the animals. Love your neighbor includes the animals and the other living beings on earth. And it's also an ecologically better alternative. You know, they make these nice little pamphlets. PETA has one, but I get one from another organization called ChristianVeg.org. And usually it works. Like, as soon as I show them that, they see, oh, this really is Christian. Okay, I like it. And then they walk away happy. And you just give it to them. And there's no confrontation. And you don't waste too much time. And you may have actually done them some good, because it makes them, you know, because they can accept when they hear from other Christians, oh, maybe we should be vegetarians. You know, they can, and they have a bunch of arguments against that too. You know, there was some dream Saint Paul had some revelation that because, you know, Christianity started among the Jewish tradition, and then Saint Paul was preaching it more widely to non-Jewish people, to Romans, you know, Gentiles, Greeks and Romans, and things that couldn't come from the Hebrew background. And the Hebrew had dietary laws, you know, that they could eat meat, but they had to eat meat only from certain kinds of animals, you know, not animals with cloven hoofs like deer, and they had to be killed in a certain way to make it kosher, you know, no pig. Also, the Muslims don't eat pork. And so there was a problem preaching. The Jews didn't want to eat with the non-Jews, It was like considered unclean and everything like that, you know, like they didn't want to lose their caste basically as Jews by eating with some Romans, you know, who would eat pigs and stuff. And then St. Paul had a dream in which there were animals and God told him to eat them, and he said, but this would be unclean. And the Lord said, if I told you to eat it, then it's not unclean. And so the Christians often use that to say, see, God said you should eat animals, and you can eat any animals, and you can eat any damn thing you want, and it doesn't matter. And but there are other arguments. Yeah, but who should you kill, and when should you kill, and why should you kill, and if you're a responsible person, and there's plenty of socially responsible food available in form of grain, and you can get milk products and stuff, is it just that you, you know, you take the milk from the cow, you feed it to your family, you eat the milk products, cheese, everything like that, and then when the when it's like your mother, the cow is like your mother, you're taking milk and drinking her milk, then when she gets too old to produce more milk, you just kill her and eat her. That's, you know, you can make these kind of arguments, but let them make those arguments to each other. There's actually a growing movement of vegetarianism among evangelical Christians, even the conservative right-wing Christians on the talk shows, radio talk shows like this guy Rush Limbaugh and stuff like that. He's actually had programs where, you know, people, Christian people were talking in favor of vegetarianism, and there's a growing movement of that. So there may be some convergence. You know, people who are not vegetarians, they have a hard time, often have a hard time understanding Krishna consciousness. Generally, like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, that Bhagavad Gita should be explained to devotees and not to those who are envious, who are not devotees, who are not austere. Who are not engaged in devotional service. So that pretty much leaves everyone out. Who are we going to just talk about Bhagavad Gita to? How many people are actually engaged in devotional service? But then later he says that if someone hears with faith and attention, then their sins are eradicated, and they dwell in the pious planets where the pious people dwell. So the fact is that if they hear without envy and some little faith to the Bhagavad Gita, then they can become purified and become devotees. And we see that Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is so powerful that when people read it, they become devotees. And they become vegetarian. You know, if you become a devotee, automatically you become vegetarian. But generally, it's hard for people when they're too involved in sinful activities, too much drinking, illicit sex, gambling, all this stuff going on, and meat eating is everywhere. It's hard for them, for a lot of people, to understand and get the message. But if we go on distributing the books and chanting, people will be influenced, or distributing prasadam, people will get that enough sukriti that they will take up the reading of the book seriously. And it answers, it fulfills the need for an explanation of religion that's not just chauvinistic, that it's our group against your group, but it's reasonable. It's not just dogmatic and authoritarianism. Yes, we have authority. We hear from authority. It's descending knowledge. We just don't start everything empirically based on what we know. But at the same time, it fulfills the need for a reasonable, universal explanation. We're not afraid of asking questions and answering questions, although we can talk about there are certain kinds of limits, that certain kind of challenging mood of questions won't help you actually understand. Srivas Pandit Prabhu.
Actually, I just had a question about the present verse we were talking.
Oh, okay.
His brother, I digressed. His brother, I forget his name.
The king's brother?
Yeah.
Samvarta.
So he is a priest, but king is a kshatriya, and he is a brahmana. So that was an interesting thing I kind of wanted to bring about. I don't know the answer, but it's a little bit of mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was the case, there is a precedence in Mahabharata where Dhritarashtra was a kshatriya, and Vidur was a Shudra because he was born of different mothers. And it's allowed because a Kshatriya can accept, or a man can accept a woman in a caste a little bit, or in a class lower than.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it's a little bit of mystery, because if Maharaj Maruta's father is a Kshatriya, he can't accept the hand of a Brahmin lady, and there is no question of...
Say who his mother was. It didn't say who his mother was, but he may be a Brahmana based on he may be qualified priest based on his qualifications. I mean, I don't know about this specific story.
The point is that
your qualification as a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Shudra, or Vaishya, it's not dependent on your birth, actually.
Right. But in those days, it was a little bit stricter hierarchy. I was just curious. Maybe, as you said, that it was more of a based on the qualification.
And Narada Muni told him to make his brother the priest. So
right.
So
maybe he initiated him. Yeah.
Maybe he initiated him. You know, there were there are stories in Ramayana. There's the story of Vishvamitra and Vashishta. You know, a Kshatriya was defeated by a Brahma Tejas, and then he said, okay, I'm going to get that. I'm going to become a Brahmana. And he did. So it can happen. And in this Krishna consciousness movement, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati said, doesn't matter. Everyone in this age, Kali Yuga, is really born as a Shudra with the qualifications of a Shudra. And that whole Vedic system and the whole Smarta system that's described based on all the birthright and everything, it's not really applicable anymore, because what people have to become Brahmana through by proper Pancharatrika initiation and accepting the rules and regulations and following the principles of a Brahmana, then you can be elevated to be able to successfully perform sacrifices. And not simply based on who your parents were. And of course, this priest was able to successfully perform the sacrifice.
Yeah, I mean, what all you said is true for the Kali Yuga. I was just curious, how did that come about? It's more of a mystery rather than anything else. Thank you for your answer, Prabhuji.
How did which come about that his brother became a
priest? Right,
yeah,
right.
It's a curious thing, yeah. Yes.
Correct, where from one generation to the next, the training and everything is practiced. So they mm-hmm. still remain Brahmins in that sense.
Yeah, if the training is proper, and they're actually learned, and they're actually pure, in their habits are pure and everything, then we can accept them as Brahmins and worthy recipients of charity and so forth. But the system has become vitiated in the modern age, where people are trying to accept the privileges based on who their parents are and stuff. But without the qualifications to perform the work. And then the sacrifices that are done don't actually bear fruit. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada was saying in this purport that... the sacrifice that should be done in this age is the Sankirtan sacrifice. And there was, at least I understand, there was agitation against Bhaktisiddhanta's movement at the time by people who are saying, no, if you're not born in a Brahmin family, then you shouldn't wear Brahmin thread or shouldn't be called a Brahmin and learn to and chant the Gayatri Mantra and these other things. And because there was agitation about, about... one social class dominating another social class, but it wasn't based on the actual... The purpose of the Brahmana social class is really to give spiritual knowledge to all people in society, and not to, get to eat first at the ceremony, and that purpose has to be fulfilled by people who can actually explain the scriptures properly. And if they can, therefore... Lord Chaitanya quoted these verses like A Vaishnava Gurur Nasyat Vaishnavo Swapacho Guru Kiba Vipra Kiba Nyasi Shudra Kena Noi She Krishna Tattva Veta She Guru Hoi. So this is the real, if you want someone who can actually give you love of Krishna. And love of Krishna is a very rare commodity. How can you get that love of Krishna? It's not very easily available. But it's available through devotees and by service to devotees and hearing from devotees. And if you make some artificial... It's the same phenomena, isn't it? You can see the same kind of phenomena as, you know, the clan of the wolf versus the clan of the bear, you know. That you're only, I'm the only way. You have to be in, you know, you have to support my social group. And that this kind of, these kind of social arrangements are there in Vedic scriptures, but they're meant for a purpose. And the purpose is, you know, in order to conduct human society in a proper way, in accordance with the laws of nature and dharma, so that everything will function smoothly and then people can make spiritual advancement. But if you become too attached to the rules and you don't understand the purpose or how to bring about the purpose or achieve the success, then it becomes you know, a symptom of what happens to religion in the age of Kali, that it becomes subservient to one group of people saying, you know, you have to do what I say, you have to follow my authority, you have to, you know, unless you are saved in my church, then you're condemned and we should be angry with you and stuff. It's the same mentality. So it's a symptom of Kali Yuga that it started like that with, you know, and in the Garuda Purana it says that demons were present when Krishna was on the planet and he was killing all the demons and, reestablishing righteousness and everything. And those who were killed in the presence of Krishna, they got liberation and they were benefited. But some people were less fortunate and they couldn't get killed in the presence of Krishna and get that liberation. But they were permitted to take birth as brahmanas in the Brahmin families in Kali Yuga. But they were demons. So in the beginning of the Kali Yuga, we see that Parikshit Maharaj, he was cursed by a little boy. Brahmins in those days, they had the power to, if they curse you, then the curses have effect. So he was cursed to die. So he shouldn't have been cursed to die. But this was a symptom that the religion was already starting from the top. That he made some mistake, but it wasn't a mistake by which the Brahmin should use his tejas to kill the king. Not just any king, but a very pious and saintly king, like Parikshit Maharaj. The little boy, 6-year-old boy or something, he used his power to kill the king because his father was insulted. Or so he thought. Then the father was very sorry and said, no, you shouldn't have done this. This was very wrong. But this was the symptom of that in this age, people, all of us, we have a lot of false ego. We get very irritated at each other. We try to become artificially dominant, and so people without the actual qualifications, assume that this is my social position because of my family. But the social position has to function right. Guna karma vibhaga saha. There's different kinds of work that has to be performed in any society. There has to be some intellectuals, some administrators, some people who produce wealth, and some people who give service and craftsmanship and labor. So it's functional. It's scientific. It's sociology, and it's a real system that's supposed to work. An actual successful ideology, just like, you know, people have capitalism and Marxism and different political ideologies and everything. Varnashram tradition is the scientific ideology that's presented in the scriptures, but it has to be understood properly and applied properly, and in order to achieve what it achieves is a peaceful and a pious society where all people are happy. It's not a means for artificial domination of the stronger groups against the weaker groups. But in Kali Yuga, it starts. You know, that's why in democracy has come about, this idea that everyone has to be level, they all have to be equal, there can't be anyone who's in a higher position in a hierarchy. Of course, that's fictional. There's hierarchies everywhere. But in this age and this atmosphere, As soon as somebody gets a lot of power, then they start grinding the other people. You know, like the French Revolution has to happen because the peasants are just being starved and not properly. It should be that, like your children, you look after your children first. You should have that sense that noblesse oblige, that the higher social classes have a duty to perform, that their duty is to take care of the others in a certain way. And when that duty stops being performed, then the whole thing becomes detestable. So in this age, even though everything's topsy-turvy, we don't have to wait. When Prabhupada first met Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he brought this challenge. He could see, actually. He accepted immediately. He didn't want to go because he'd seen so many sadhus. And, you know, his father was always introducing him to sadhus, and he felt that they were hypocrites. They were smoking bidis, and they weren't really, you know. So he thought this will be another one like that. But as soon as he met Bhaktisiddhanta, his friend Narendra brought him there. And as soon as he saw him preaching, he said, oh, this person is competent to actually spread Lord Chaitanya's teachings all over the world. But he challenged. It was the 1920s, he was wearing homespun, he was involved in the Quit India movement of Mahatma Gandhi, and he told Bhaktisiddhanta, you want to spread the message of Lord Chaitanya all over the world, but who will listen to this message while we're still a dependent nation? First we have to achieve independence, and then we can preach Krishna consciousness and people will listen to Indian, you know, independence. And Bhaktisiddhanta defeated him, and he said, it doesn't have to wait for any material condition. The urgency is simply to present Krishna consciousness. We don't have to say, first we have to have a Varnashram society, first we have to have a king who is qualified or something like that. That would help. It would be nice if the political leaders actually supported, Sankirtan. In American Constitution, the government can't establish any particular religion, and that's been interpreted in different ways. The Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. But the idea there is to protect, that everyone should be free to practice their own faith and shouldn't feel that their, you know, faith is being oppressed by some government authority. These are all protections. These are rights of protections to keep people from being exploited and being victims of injustice. Of course, when they did the Constitution, they also had slavery. The people from African descent were enslaved and forced to work, and sometimes even sold. You know, their children or their wife or something could be sold to some other plantation somewhere away and never see them again. And there's so many injustices going on still. It's not that I'm not saying the American system was a perfect system or something, but I'm saying these ideas of democracy and rights and equality and so forth, you know, evolved and were created over time in an environment to deal with historical factors of unjust domination by strong groups against weak groups and protections. And even the religious freedom, you know, evolved in this atmosphere as the result of what I was saying before, that in the 1500s the whole Christian church in Europe broke apart, and then it caused lots of wars. And in England there were civil wars. Whether the king would be a Catholic or a Protestant was a big issue. And how to deal with that issue and maintain peace in society. And they eventually developed this liberal philosophy, which said, the main thing is we have to keep everyone getting along and keep the market functioning and business going so we can go about our business. And then your own personal, you know, highest conception of morality and the goal of life and virtue and greatness, that can be private. Different people can have different ones. And we can still meet in the marketplace and do business according to certain rules of, you know, a level playing field and have everything. And, you know, this was a particular invention that, you know, that developed historically at a particular time. And so it's process-oriented, due process of law. People have to be properly treated according to their position and not being given so respect for just who they are. Like we have the phrase, you know, we have a government of laws, not of men. It's not just that one person becomes in a powerful position and can use corruption and stuff. I'm droning on, I guess, a little bit, but these things developed historically in a certain way, and it is a way to defeat something that was negative, but it doesn't have a positive side to it. They don't have anything to say. The whole, even the utilitarian ethics of, you know, Jeremy Bentham and the whole, you know, Scottish Enlightenment, the Adam Smith and Ricardo and Hume there's not a positive vision of what is the goal of life. It's like everyone is allowed to discover their own goal of life. If you have money in your pocket, you can decide how you want to spend it, and however you spend it over large masses of people, the economists will say, well, that kind of describes the value of things and what's good and what isn't good. And the problem is people don't really know what's good. This was so Marx and Rousseau and other philosophers criticized that you have this you're deciding what is good, the greatest good for the greatest number. You're deciding what is good just based on you know what you know, you're assuming that every adult rational being will make rational decisions and choose the right things, what's good for them. But they don't know what's good for them. There actually does have to be a sort of patronistic philosophy where those who are actually wise should be able to tell you that you know, this isn't good. Otherwise, I was just in Haribo. Someone's talking. I was just in Las Vegas, and this is the result of, you know, American liberalism, that, you know, the lower class people think what's good is prostitution, liquor, gambling, and meat eating, really, eating any kind of abominable thing that they could think of, and that this is their playground, you know, their idea, you know, their holy place of American civilization is really, you know, this resort. They even call it Sin City, and they revel in it. You know, they like that name. Well, we're Sin City. This is where you can come, and you can do whatever, commit all the sins that you want, and no one will know about it. And what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. They advertise themselves like that, you know, just the right amount of bad. When you get there, I've never been there. I'd previously stopped over in the airport, but I hadn't actually got out of the airport. And this time, so there was this convention of Asian American hotel owners, so I was there. But it was amazing that you get even to the airport, and there's all these signs about, you know, naked dance shows and naked men, naked women, you know, massage, erotic, you know, right in the airport. And also slot machines are everywhere. In the airport, they have slot machines. If you stop at the gas station to fill up your gas, you could, you know, throw some money into these machines to see if you can, if they'll give you more money back for your money. And they have signs up, say, get the Las Vegas mob experience. And they have a picture of, like, an Italian mafioso guy, you know. And I don't even know what that's about. You know, but this is the vision of the culture when the low-class materialistic people live out their fantasies of what the good life is. It becomes this completely degraded civilization that's causing everybody to go to hell.
It would seem that it's a right environment to distribute the Bhagavad Gita.
Yes, it seems like a good environment. Yeah, that was immediately my feeling when I got there. We have to do more sankirtan here. This, you know, we have to. But we should feel like that everywhere. Let's face it. Even in San Jose, you know, we need to do a lot of sankirtan. You know. But when you get to Las Vegas, there's this real feeling that it's, you know, it's just a monument to crass materialism and degraded sinful activity, and you feel like they need more. They need a lot of sankirtan here.
How many books?
So we took orders for over 8,000 books, 8,000 something, and we met a lot of nice people. We met a lot of people who. They had smaller hotels, so a lot more order. We got like sort of more orders than we typically did. It wasn't the convention was not as crowded as we had hoped, And our booth was in a place where it didn't get as much traffic as we had hoped. But we were able to meet people who already have the books in their rooms. We took some, I hope the videos came out because it was a noisy room and we didn't have special sound equipment and everything. But we took some testimonial videos from people talking about their experiences of having the Gitas in their rooms. And, you know, we're gradually making it more famous. But the real truth is, when we started it, we were thinking, well, we have to get them to pay for the books too. And even the first convention we went to in Washington, D.C., we decided that our line would be that we can give you the books eventually when we get enough donations to fulfill your order. But if you can donate $2 a book now or something, we'll give them to you immediately. And by now we're starting to say $4 a book is really what our cost is when you all things considered. The costs have gone up and also shipping and everything like that. But we find that that complicates it too much. With these people, we have to concentrate on convincing them that they should have the books in their room. And if we don't get Prabhupada's Gitas in the room, somebody else's Gitas will go into the room that are not as it is. People sometimes complain, oh, this is too big, it's too complicated, we want a different Gita, we want something, you know. So we have to really do this. But to get them in the rooms, we're telling them, you don't have to give a donation, don't worry about it, we'll get the money somewhere else. If you give a donation, it's nice, but we're not there's no charge. Because if you tell them there's a charge, a lot of them will say, I don't think I'm going to do it. Even when there's no charge. Sometimes they say, well, the Bibles come without a charge, you should do it without a charge. So we're going to have to do some fundraising to figure out how to get enough money to fulfill these orders. Like, you know, if it's 8,000, it was really like 8,300 books. And there were a lot more orders, actually, but there were people that said, well, I have 600 rooms, send me 50 books now and I'll see how I like it. Or, you know, we have 600 rooms or 1,000 rooms, but, you know, I got to talk to my partner, I got to talk to my father. And sometimes In the past, we racked up big scores of big numbers, but they were, you know, there was always one or two, you know, 800 books, 1,000 books, and then later when it came to fulfill those orders, people didn't take the books, or they wouldn't return our calls and communicate with us, and there was, you know, but this one is a lot of smaller orders we found a lot of people that really had a high level of interest. And that we're interested in, you know, you find some people that are going to tell their friends and tell their family members, and let's do this, it's time, we should do it now. One kind of resistance, the biggest kind of resistance we meet is people are concerned that the books will be disrespected in the hotel rooms. And they say it's bad enough to have Bibles in our rooms. We have to have Bibles in our rooms because it's in our contract with our franchisers. But we don't like it because we find the Bibles are torn, they're written on, they're thrown away, and we hate to think what will they do to Bhagavad Gitas in this country, and some people will do, and if anybody does that, it will be a sin, and it will reflect on us that we've made it available for them. And so we have to tell them that it's a risk is there, but if one person's life is changed and they become a devotee, there's that it's worth all that risk. And, you know, maybe... You know, if you had, and we were asking, like, what have you had, good comments and bad comments? And they were saying, the comments are usually, you know, 4 or 5 to 1, good comment, in favor of good comments. A lot of people, you know, come and say, can I take it with me? You know, can I buy it from you? I really like it. Thank you for providing this. And then every once in a while, you get mainly some born-again Christian who says, you know, this is America. We're Christians. Don't try to push this foreign thing, you know. Yes.
And we are actually placing the small book, the soft copy.
This one, yeah.
Which is, when they say, you know, it's too thick or complicated, this is the one that we are placing.
Yeah.
Which is about what the Bible is. And in terms of cost, it is one half the cost of the hardbound copy.
I've met some people who said, well, we want hardbound books, and we're willing to pay for it. And I said, well, if you're willing to pay for it, we can provide it. The blue ones, those ones on the rack there.
The previous edition, but
right.
It's now replaced by the
right.
One that you're holding.
So the ones that we gave out 200, also in addition to taking orders for 8,300 or something, we also just gave out 240 copies. At the, we had 10 boxes, and at the, and we gave out 240 CDs as well. We gave out little wrapped packages. Some devotees took a lot of care to make these nice little wrapped presents that had, a refrigerator magnet and a CD and a small book, like Perfection of Yoga or something like that inside, and some other things.
And the improvement over this is, this was just the English translation, but now the shloka.
This has the Sanskrit shlokas in it. Yeah. So the ones that already have the books in their hotels, they said they had that version. And the ones that we're now giving this version, we should have pointed out that though that version doesn't have the Sanskrit shlokas, this one does have the Sanskrit shlokas. I didn't point that out to anybody. But it's attractive, it's quite attractive, this. And really, we could, if we really just wanted to push and say, if we had a mountain peak of gold, as it said in the verse and purport today, we probably could really get the word out quickly in different ways. I should write some articles, get it into some of the different publications, like Ahoa has a magazine, and if we write the right kind of article to hit the right note, they'll put it in their magazine. Because you can only meet so many people at these conventions, and not everybody really, even everybody that's there, not everybody comes by your booth and gets to know about it. And the organizers don't want us to walk outside of the booths and meet people elsewhere and stuff like that. But the problem, we're going to have to find some donors who are willing to support this, And we may find some large donors, maybe in India or something like that, who say, "This is really a historical thing that's changing the culture of America." Books are tangible things that children are going to grow up learning that when you stay in a hotel, there's a Bhagavad Gita in the drawer. That wasn't the case 5 years ago or 10 years ago, but that will be the case going forward. And maybe we'll eventually be able to introduce them in the larger hotels and the luxury hotels where the movers and shakers and more educated elite people will get a chance to browse the Bhagavad Gita, which they might not take time to do otherwise. But right now we're mostly in the economy motels, the Days Inns, the Super 8s, the Econo Lodges, and the Motel 6 and stuff. But it's really a historical cultural change in the life of America, and the people don't realize it's kind of a subtle. They don't realize the power. These are transcendental books. They're endowed with Srila Prabhupada's transcendental, realizations, his emotional ecstasies, and they really do change people's lives when they read them. People do become devotees, and pretty much everybody you meet who's become a devotee in ISKCON has, mainly done it through actually spending time reading Prabhupada's books and being convinced in that way. So it's gonna have a big effect. But do we want to?
You should have some label on that. You don't change your faith. You have to strengthen your faith.
Uh huh. Yeah. There's different ideas. One guy was telling me that instead of Bhagavad Gita as it is, we could have that down at the bottom. We should call it Holy Gita. So the people will know it's a holy book, there's all these different good suggestions. There could be just a hotel edition that was made with, and people have suggested that we have, just like the Gideon's Bible has, like in the front, it has different verses for people who are in need of different kinds of things, for people who are depressed, for people who are having family problems, for people who need inspiration in different ways, and they have them by categories and stuff. So people were saying maybe we could have. I think it would be nice to have some front matter that just sort of explains to people, the history and background of Bhagavad Gita, its relationship to Mahabharata, how its relationship to Hinduism, and and also as a work of world literature where it sort of belongs. So they'll have a sense that, you know, it's not just a, you know, a lot of times when people read the Bhagavad Gita, you know, when you go buy a book and start to read a book from a bookstore or something, usually you have to, you know, like a novel, they'll have some, you know, something catchy happens in the first few pages. Somebody gets murdered or, you know, you get sucked into the whole world of the book and you're hooked. And in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, you know, Duryodhana is talking about all the different soldiers who are on this side and that side, and they have this list of these long Sanskrit names. And for people who don't know Mahabharata and have no idea how to pronounce those names, it can put them off because they just think, oh, you know, what is this book? It's a whole list of these unpronounceable, complicated names. So, you know, you have to, if you have something in front to tell them the book and the main, you know, sort of mood of the book and everything like that, and they don't start reading from page one and then just put it down and say, I can't pronounce these names, you know.
But if they read Srila Prabhupada's introduction, it will kind of,
yes,
yeah,
Srila Prabhupada's introduction is very powerful and very important. Now you get negative comments. I met one guy, I hate even to repeat his negative comments, but I met one young Indian-American kid that, you know, a child of immigrant, and he wasn't that interested in Bhagavad Gita at all. But he said, yeah, I tried to read this Bhagavad Gita, but, you know, when I read this Prabhupada's, you know, this author, I don't think he said Prabhupada, and he said, you know, I started reading the introduction and he sounded like, you know, he was talking about how his was better than somebody else's, and I didn't like that. So, but it didn't put me off. Later I read some other one, somebody else's Bhagavad Gita, you know. And then I was trying to explain to him, no, but there really are people who don't interpret it as it's meant to be interpreted, that don't understand that Krishna is really identifying himself, the person Krishna, as the Supreme Godhead. But he was kind of a dull-headed boy and he wasn't that interested.
This name, Holy Gita, that you mentioned, it has been used
by the
name Holy Gita has been used by the Chinmaya mission.
Uh-huh.
So Swami Chinmaya Nanda from their mission calls his translation Holy Gita.
And maybe this guy that was saying that, he's been saying that, but maybe he's been influenced by the Chinmaya mission. Although it's not a bad idea, but I found that, like, we were in the section of the convention that was the charities and the nonprofits and stuff like that. So next to me was the Sri Sri Ravi Shankar's Art of Living Foundation. And so the guy that was in that booth was saying, oh, you know, we have a book, you know, like one of our spiritual leaders has written a book where it has quotations from the different religious scriptures of the world and, you know, shows how they're all related and stuff. We should put that book in hotels, you know. And everybody has their ideas, you know, and they're all enthusiastic and stuff. But that's why I'm seeing now that now that we've started this and we're really doing it, and we've got a publishing company and an organization that's sufficient, you know, that we have an opportunity to get Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita in the motels. And it's important that we do that and we establish that and stake out that beachhead, because Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita will be much more beneficial than, you know, some Mayavadi Bhagavad Gita that tries to say that it's all an allegory and that really Krishna isn't really Krishna, but he's a symbol for something impersonal or something like that. Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Transcendental Book Distribution Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Gopremanandi.